Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing.
And Bubba Wallace.
You know what's the worst part of a race? A rain delay.
Sitting around, waiting for the track to dry, is dull.
But instead of waiting, we hang out with Chumba Casino.
Social casino slots, bingo, solitaire, plenty of fun to keep us entertained.
So why let a rain delay slow you down? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Nerds. Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Ever Google a money question and end up 12 tabs deep with 12 different answers? This podcast is your shortcut back to clarity. NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast breaks down financial decisions with a team of trusted journalists. They explain the why behind decisions like investing, home buying, and choosing credit cards with clear, research-backed insights. No jargon, no misinformation. Make your next financial move with confidence. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast on your favorite podcast app.
He's a well-respected high school football scout, known for his unpopular opinion and brash commentary.
The coach, Keith Miller.
They bring you the transparent truth, the world's number one source for high school football recruiting news and interviews. The transparent truth.
Welcome. You're now listening to the Transparent Truth. It's your boy, Coach Keith. Five Star Friday. Excited about my special guest today, a blast from the past, a relationship from long ago that's been steady running for over 15 years. Excited about my guest, but before I introduce him, we have to remind you on every show that we have a sleeper of the week.
Hey, we want to remind everybody, tune in every Wednesday for our sleeper of the week segment. Really want to thank our guy, Larry Miller. He's allowing us to showcase unknown prospects that need to be brought to the spotlight. Larry is all about family and community, and his support is helping to change the lives of young players across the country. Each week, young men are getting scholarship offers after being featured on this show. So thank you, Larry. When we have business and a man that is really entrenched in the community, we need to show our support right back at him. Sit and Sleep is the only place that offers advanced sleep technology. Greg?
Body diagnostics. That's five-star stuff. This is high-quality stuff. Lay down on a mattress, and within seconds, thousands of sensors can help you find the absolute right mattress for you.
Wow, within seconds?
Seconds.
Man, that's awesome.
Sit and Sleep.
They'll beat anyone's advertised price, or your mattress is free. Appreciate you, Larry Miller.
Thank you, Larry.
And we're back. Thank you, first of all, for everybody joining me here on this Five Star Friday. Got a special guest going to be talking about some issues in the news, some major topics. Odell Beckham and his drama. We're going to talk a little UCLA football. Talk a little Dallas Cowboys, Mike McCarthy. Okay, we talk a little Aaron Hernandez. Got a chance to watch the Aaron Hernandez docuseries last night. I binge watched it. Just an intriguing story about a young fella with a lot of issues and a lot of personal problems, emotional problems, psychological problems that I think were compounded by his environment, by his excess because of success and a lot of different things. So we'll get to that in just a second, and I'd like to bring in my guest right now.
All right, now I'd like to bring in our Five Star Friday guest. Probably one of my favorite people to be around in the whole world, a guy with a lot to say, a very big sense of humor, and I'm very close to him now and have been for the last, I want to say, 15 years. I want to bring in none other than 2013 NBA first-round pick from the UCLA Bruin All-Conference selection, from the Compton High School All-American defensive end, Mr. Dayton Jones. Dayton, what's going on? What's good?
How you doing, Big Keith? Man, thank you for having me here. Very excited to be on the podcast. And, man, ready to talk about so many different topics and, you know, get a few laughs in and, you know, ready to address the media on a few major topics. You know, so if you're listening, man, engage, get close to your computers, your phones, tablets, whatever you need, and let's enjoy a great conversation.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, let's not waste any time, Dayton. Let's go ahead and dive in. So there are a lot of issues that are, you know, hot-button topics right now across the country, across the world. Odell Beckham, he's having some issues. We'll talk a little bit about that. Definitely the Aaron Hernandez situation, docuseries, and just the whole story, the life story of Aaron Hernandez just came out on Netflix. We'll talk a little UCLA football. Of course, you're a UCLA graduate. They've got some issues there in Westwood, absolutely. And Chip Kelly's got to get that thing turned around fully, really soon, I believe. We'll talk a little bit about the Dallas Cowboys. Of course, you're a former Dallas Cowboy, and your former head coach of the Green Bay Packers, Mike McCarthy, gets the job there in Arlington.
Great pickup.
And you say it's a great pickup. So we'll talk a little bit about that. So let's start at the jump. For people who don't know Dayton Jones, why don't you give them a little background about yourself so they can get more familiarized with you?
So my name is Dayton Jones, former first-round pick, a guy from South Central Los Angeles, you know, but I like to claim Compton, California. You know, that's where my heart is, and that's where, you know, the bulk of my life, that's where I spent most of my time, and I learned a lot of many hard lessons and had a lot of great success in the 3-1-0. And, you know, for me, I come from a big family. And, you know, for me, you know, I was raised by a single family, a single parent mom. You know, she raised one of six kids in the city of Compton, California. And for me, it was a lot of trials and tribulations growing up, you know what? But for me, growing up with a large family, it made me a competitor because I was the second youngest out of my family, and I grew up with a lot of girls in my family. You know, I have four sisters and one older brother, and you know, my brother being the oldest and the 6-year gap with me and him in between with three other girls, you know, it made me kind of tough. It made me extremely tough, but it made me more competitive, you know, always trying to be better than my older brother, always, you know, being a protector of my older sisters and my younger sister. And just coming from the environment that I come from, you know, not many people make it at all. And for us, it was all about just surviving the day and, you know, making ends, you know, watching my mom trying to make ends meet and, you know, you know, being a great kid and, you know, not really seeing too many of the things outside or not letting a lot of things from the outside affect my upbringing. But, you know, I got a major book that's going to come out and, you know, hopefully we turn that to a future docuseries. Hopefully it get picked up. But right now I'm writing the story and I'm working on it. The story is still not all the way written, but we have a boatload of work that's going into it, to the project. And it's already a great read so far, and it's definitely going to be an engaging read for a lot of kids that grew up in the same similar, or might have had the same similar situation as me, but really don't know which way to turn or who to actually go to for help, or, you know what I mean? They don't really know how to climb out that hole that they're in. So for me, my story is all about, you know, giving a real piece of me and some of the things that I've seen in my life, and ultimately, you know, sprinkling a little bit of me into their lives, and, you know, just giving them a taste that, you know, there is a way out, even if it's not athletics, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So you grew up in Compton, went to Compton High School, you were a top player, you went off to UCLA, you graduated 5 years there at UCLA, became a first-round draft pick of the Green Bay Packers. Mike McCarthy was your head coach, who is now the newly hired coach at the Dallas Cowboys, and we'll get into that later on down the road. You jumped around the league a couple times, played 7 years in the league, still working on getting a chance to get back into the league. But here you are on Five Star Friday, and I'm happy to have you. You told us actually one of my former players, somebody that I love dearly and has always had the best wishes for him in his lifetime. So I'm glad he's jumping on the show today for Five Star Friday. Let's get into the topics for today, Dayton. Let's talk about Odell Beckham. Now, you have a little history with Odell Beckham. For those fans who don't know, Odell Beckham, he was on the field after the national championship game, giving away money to LSU football players. And then, you know, shortly thereafter, he's in the locker room, and there's a police officer in the locker room. Odell Beckham smacks him on the behind and then starts dancing in front of him. The police, they have issued a warrant for his arrest in New Orleans. So, Dayton, what do you think about all this Odell Beckham drama? Giving money to the players on the field after the game, being recorded smacking a police officer on his bottom. What do you think about all this?
Well, number one, my major concern is before we address the Odell Beckham situation, I just want the world to understand this. You know, as a former collegiate athlete, we already most guys already have a hard time with actually coming back to the university and being acknowledged once they're out of the collegiate, you know, level, because most colleges change head coaches every other year. So when these colleges change their head coaches and their entire coaching staff, they don't really welcome most guys back on the sidelines unless you're a guy that broke records, or, you know, they hung a banner for you, or, you know what I'm saying, or you donated
sure.
money to the program. You get what I'm saying? So in my eyes, I feel like Odell kind of compromised, you know, collegiate athletes across the nation at every Division I or Division II, you know, program, with actually being on the field to, you know, coming back home on their bye week and actually being able to stand on their sidelines proud and wear their college colors and supporting their cast without having to be, you know, outcasted to the stands, you know, where you're surrounded and attacked by most of the fans, you can't really enjoy the game. So number one, I think he compromised all former NFL players, I mean, all former collegiate players who are now playing on the next level, with actually being able to stand on the sidelines. Because now, you know, we've seen it happen with Miami. You know, guys make big hits or score touchdowns, they celebrate after, you know, after that season. Once you win a national championship, you know, the NCAA, you know, most people write letters and call in, and then now the NCAA comes down hard on most of these people, I mean, most of these programs, and they enforce the new rule. Oh, you can't excessively celebrate. Oh, you can't do this, because now it becomes, you know, a sportsmanship issue. And I think that Odell made the situation in LSU being in the national championship more about himself and his marketing than just coming out there and embracing LSU football with all the other former alumni that was actually at the game. I saw Patrick Peterson on the sidelines. I saw Kevin Minner on the sidelines. I saw
a lot of great former Tigers,
you know, Tigers on those sidelines for both teams. And I even seen Ezekiel Elliott there, and none of them acted a fool. You know what I'm saying? And for him to jeopardize his teammates and a lot of guys, student athletes who are still on the team's eligibility, I just think that he could have handled the situation a little bit better. If you want to pay the guys, man, go get a McDonald's bag, you know, put it in their lockers. You know, you can get any kind of a lunch bag, a Target bag, put it in their lockers and keep it on the low. Hush it up, you know, and, you know, dap a guy up outside of the cameras. You know, if you're doing things on the camera, you're making it about yourself. You know, I saw when Ed Orgeron was giving the team speech, you know, he was out speaking Coach O, and I was just like, man, this guy's making it about himself. I trained with Odell Beckham for a few off seasons, and I'm, you know, I love him to death, and I believe he's a great player. But I think the thing that's going to haunt his career is just the celebrity of Odell Beckham. And I think him as a celebrity and a star football player, I think that he has to be more conscious of the way people are going to embrace him, because he could get the Floyd Mayweather treatment, or he could get the Muhammad Ali treatment. And, you know, most people view Muhammad Ali as an icon, a legend. You know, most people view Floyd Mayweather, you know, he's the GOAT. But most people view him as being cocky. They don't want to be around him because he got the money. He's a showboat. And it's not about that. It's about bringing people up, making people want to be like you. And, you know, I don't think he carried himself in a great light. And I don't think he carried the LSU program in a great, great light that night, because that's arguably one of the best collegiate football teams in college football history that we saw play on that Monday night.
No question about it. Great football team, and definitely felt like Odell Beckham really took the spotlight away from the players. Out there on the field with Cash, handling the players, again, that could have been done very very low-key, could have been done behind closed doors, whatever the case may be. But, again, feeding his own ego, feeding his own celebrity, trying to be in the middle of the spotlight, definitely is causing some issues now for not only the football players and the football program, but I think LSU as a university. So we'll see what transpires after that. But, you know, adding on to Beckham that he creates.
We have a great fan in the NFL. Number one, protect the shield, right? And then it's always on every level, no matter what, don't do anything to where your teammates is going to have to answer questions on your behalf. You get what I'm saying?
Right.
That's where you become a distraction. Don't do anything wrong to where your teammates got to answer questions on your behalf. We got to get ready for a game. We're talking about LSU. We're talking about college and how this guy is giving away money. You know, and on top of that, now he's facing an assault charge on the cops, which I think that cop, the police officer, was an Alabama. I think he was an Alabama fan, you know. It's sportsmanship, good game, you know. Guys are smoking cigars in the locker room, drinking champagne like they should have. You know, they went undefeated. Most of those guys were going into the NFL draft. This is the last time most of these guys are going to ever be in a locker room together. And everybody knows how special no matter what level you're on, everybody knows how special the football locker room is. It's a safe haven. It's a secret place. It's like a club that nobody else can get into but you guys. And everything that happens in the locker room stays in the locker room. You know what I'm saying? And everything that happened there should have stayed in there.
Well, you know, it's not the first time that the LSU locker room has been on videotape. Of course, Coach O was video recorded early in the season screaming "fuck you" to Alabama, and now Odell Beckham is on video smacking an officer on the behind. And regardless, you know, in my opinion, regardless of that, if it was sportsmanship, you don't put your hands on another person, whether it be female, or whether it be male, whether it be a reporter, police officer. You don't put your hands on another person unless they have consented for you to do that. Of course, that wasn't the case in this situation. Now, Odell, again, facing charges of simple battery. But, you know, just to reiterate, making it all about himself, putting his hands on people, talking over the coach, giving money to guys on the field. When is Odell going to learn to reel it in, protect the university, and stop having other people answer questions about him?
You know what? And that's where it comes in to play. You know, you got to be, you know, it's about integrity. It's about doing the right thing when nobody's watching, you know. And for him, you know, he has to learn that he's carrying a certain burden of celebrity that most guys does not have. You know, the lone snapper on each team doesn't have that celebrity. It can't go around, you know, acting the way he acts at times. And, you know, like I said, I respect Odell Beckham, you know, as an athlete. I don't really know him as a person too well, but I respect him as an athlete, you know. But I think that once he comes into his own, as far as him being, you know, having a little bit more integrity, I think that his game will vastly improve as well, too. You know, He's already shown that he can be a great player. You know, it's all about being consistent now and having a little bit of consistency to himself and respecting, you know, the organization of LSU and respecting his name and the name on the back of his jersey. You know what I'm saying? And he got to understand that, you know, it's not about him. I kind of feel like, you know, he hangs out with Drake. You know, Drake is one of his best friends. Drizzy Drake is one of his best friends. And if you can see at every sporting event, you know, you watch, you know, Drake didn't, as you can see, Drake didn't show up to the LSU game, you know. Drake didn't show up to the LSU game. But I was very surprised at that. You know, you watch how Drake acted during the Toronto Raptors championship Drake right. kind of made it about himself a little bit. I kind of forgot who was on the team, and you know, Drake kissed the trophy before everybody else kissed the trophy, and I kind of felt like, you know, it was a trickle effect down with Odell Beckham. We're trying to be in that top priority celebrity, you know. And
that's a good point.
You are who you hang around, you know. You are who
there's
you hang
no
around.
Question about it. There's a definite correlation between the way Drake behaved during last year's NBA final and the way Odell Beckham behaved this earlier this week during the national or after the national championship game. But I digress. It's time to move on. Odell Beckham, we know, has, you know, some ego issues, and he definitely needs to get his celebrity under control. Let's move along. Another hot topic is Aaron Hernandez docuseries on Netflix. And I got a chance to binge watch last night The Mind of a Killer, you know, the story of Aaron Hernandez. And what a three-part docuseries it was. It was fascinating, to say the least. It was explosive on the low end, from his childhood all the way up until his, you know, untimely, you know, suicide. There was consistent trauma. I believe that there was a mental illness. I think there was success, which really allowed for access, easy access to things. So between the trauma, the mental illness, and the success with access, it really led to his demise. It really led to his downfall. It led to his self-destruction. And I want to talk to you a little bit about, you know, Aaron Hernandez and some of the things that he said. And let's start at the beginning. He says in the NFL, go ahead.
Oh, no, you got it. I want to hear what you got to say.
Well, he says in the NFL, all guys really need to survive is weed and Toradol. How do you respond to that?
Oh my gosh, that's deep. Number one, I've never dealt with Toradol. But I did go through my fair share of issues with substance abuse. And, you know, I could stand tall and say, you know, hey, I did go through my fair share of substance abuse at one point in my life. I was a younger guy. And being a first-round pick, you know, I felt like, you know, nobody could tell me anything. And you know, I could go smoke some marijuana, use substance, you know, these substance abuse, and go out here and still be the same guy. Well, I noticed I started losing friends. I noticed that I started losing a lot of respect. I noticed that people weren't viewing me as the same community leader. And I noticed that my girlfriend at the time, which is now my wife, she was not reciprocating towards substances of abuse. And it was starting to become a downfall in my life. And, you know, I think that I was saved because I had somebody who was actually there to tell me, you're wrong. You're very wrong. And a lot of guys in the National Football League, you know, use these different substances of abuse to cope. They use marijuana to, you know, some guys use it for recovery. Some guys use it because they're going through a lot of different things at home. You know, they're not in the locker room. A lot of people don't understand the locker room is a safe haven. It's a place to escape most times. Some guys don't even want to retire because they didn't want to be at home, you know, to deal with the everyday pressures of being at home with not having a schedule. And for me, I hear that. I see it as an excuse because, you know, when you're playing peewee football, you know, you're playing high school football or collegiate football, you're just playing it to have fun and, you know, get an opportunity to, you know, score touchdowns or get sacks or interceptions and, you know, this, that, and the third. And when you start making a game about everything but football, that's when you start to have a downfall. You know, and I think that him saying that, you know, he was only 23 years old. You know, most people don't get a $40 million contract at 23 years old. I played my first game at 23 years old. You know, he was getting a new $40 million contract at 23 years old. So for him, he came into the game very young. I think he came into the game at 20 years old. And for him, he had a lot of early success, and he probably didn't have a lot of people telling him the right things and guiding him the right way.
Yeah, there's no question about it. He definitely had some enablers around him. The next thing I want to talk to about with Aaron Hernandez is when he passed, when he committed suicide, the attorney was very, very adamant about getting his brain tested for CTE. And after all the tests were done, doctors came with the conclusion that Aaron Hernandez had a very advanced case of CTE, and now people are pointing to CTE as the reason he became so violent and abrupt and impulsive. But I think it begs the question, Aaron Hernandez was the same type of guy at 23 as he was at 12. So to blame it, do you think blaming it on CTE is the right thing to do, or is that accurate?
I think that's very wrong. You know, I watched Ray Lewis go out and destroy people for years, for 15 years. I watched Tom Brady. I was telling somebody the other day, I said, you know, Tom Brady has been hit more times in his life than I've hit quarterbacks or made tackles in my whole career. I said, you don't see Tom Brady out here killing anyone or, you know, fighting anybody at bars. I said, you don't think he has CTE? Said, he just got issued a new helmet this year. He was playing with the old helmet. So I think that Aaron Hernandez was dealing with some issues that was deeper than CTE and football hit. I think that most people make up excuses now. You don't want to play football because you have CTE. No, that's not the case. Yeah, you have a strong chance of getting CTE, but you can't make that an excuse, you know, on why you killed somebody. I think he had issues in the home with his mother and father, you know, and it's great because he grew up in a household with both parents, you know, but they probably weren't the best examples on him and his brothers. They, like I said, I just started watching the documentary, and from what I've taken from that is that, you know, his dad was a great guy. He was a family man. He put food on the table, but he actually got into, you know, these substances of abuses, and a lot of people don't realize that alcohol is an even worse drug than marijuana, you know. And his dad had come home drunk, and they told the story where his mom threw the cell phone at his dad, and the dad came and beat her head into, you know, the bathroom sink until she was unconscious. And I'm like sitting there thinking to myself, like, wow, these boys had to see this and endure this, you know. So number one, that raises the eyebrow that, okay, you know, my dad, they called their dad the king. I saw a picture in the yearbook, his name was the king, you know. And as the king, as the man of the house, you know, you got a strong father, you know, that's pushing athletics and, you know, that's all pushing athletics and education. Number one, he taught them to be strong dudes. You know, you can't be soft, crying is soft, you know. So, number one, you know, and I feel like, you know, I know down the line they talked about his sexuality and this, that, and the third. You know, so he already had a tough upbringing to where he couldn't come and talk to his parents about certain things. You know, he had to be a tough guy. And I think those are some of the things that came down and haunted him, you know, as being a father. You know, I haven't got to the part where how his relationship with his new wife was going down. I don't know if he was domestically abusive to her. You know, I know he had a daughter. I don't know if he was domestically abusive to her or anything, but you know, if you're watching your dad beat on your mom, you know, I'm pretty sure if the wife, his wife argued with him, he's probably doing the same thing. You know, his dad was an alcoholic. Aaron Hernandez liked like marijuana. He also liked alcohol. And he liked Toradol, which means that he probably liked pills as well, too. So, you know, he was heavily on so many different substances of abuse. And I don't think that he had any direct help with the NFL on getting these things figured out, because he was a 23-year-old man that just came off a rookie contract. He made all that money off a rookie contract, and now he was making, you know, roughly probably $10 million a year, you know, and you couldn't tell no 23-year-old that was making $10 million a year anything over 4 years.
Yeah, there's no question about it. There were a lot of, it's kind of a Molotov cocktail of issues and substance abuse, trauma, and mental illness, and really led to him becoming a sociopath. They talked about, you know, and I think it's important for us to reiterate that you have not seen the entire documentary. You've seen about the first 30 minutes of the first episode, and there's three episodes. But he did talk about how you know, when his dad died, he did not cry, not one tear. That's very abnormal.
That's very abnormal.
That detachment from his emotions is indicator number one that we may have a sociopath on our hands, right?
Most definitely.
That's indicator number one, right? And if you add to that, you know, the trauma from his childhood, right? Why being beat up by his father? He talked about you felt it when he came home drunk. You felt it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Being beat up by his father, right? Watching his mom being beat up by his father, right? Also being sexually abused by a family friend, right? A babysitter, and you'll get a chance to listen to that whole story once you watch the docuseries. Being sexually abused. Not only that, but sexually experimenting with this high school quarterback, right? So
yeah,
you talk about substances of abuse between the weed, the Toradol, the pills. In addition to that, you talk about, you know, the makings of a sociopath at a young age, and also the emotional and psychological trauma that he experienced as a child, adolescent, and a teenager, all mixed into one big pot of jambalaya, and there you have a guy that can kill without emotion and feel nothing after taking away people's lives.
And the thing that let me know, like, from the first 10 minutes of the docuseries, the thing that I pinpointed was when the correctional officer said Aaron Hernandez just moved in like it was nothing. He was saying, he pretty much said, you know, you'll talk to him, he said, oh, this is nothing. I'm at training camp. I'm in a 7x10 cell. I'm in training camp. You know, this is nothing. So for him, I feel like Aaron Hernandez was just always looking for an escape from what was burning up and really inside of him. You know, and I felt like he didn't really know how to express himself, because he always had to be so tough, and he always had to be just this macho guy. He was on the phone with his wife, and he was talking to his wife, and he was like, you know, babe, my body is shaking right now. I'm shaking. And she was like, why are you shaking? He was like, I almost got into a fight with a guy. And the guy, you know, his wife was telling him, you don't have to be so macho. You can talk to me. You can cry over the phone. You can do this. And I felt like Aaron Hernandez never had that person that he could come to and just vent and cry to, because he always had to hide who he really was inside. And there's a lot of guys that's hiding who they really are inside, you know, and they don't really know how to express themselves, and they don't really have no outlet or no true help to go and express themselves, because it's so hard with handling all these things and holding on to all these different vices, and you don't really have nobody that you can come and talk to and express yourself to and get actual help, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's definitely a tough position for a young man who had those types of issues to be in, which kind of leads me to my next point with Aaron Hernandez. I don't know if it's a point, but, you know, just the next kind of topic with Aaron Hernandez is Aaron Hernandez hides his sexuality.
Mm.
And they interviewed
a former Patriots player who also came out later on in his career when he, I think he got out of the league, that he was gay. How prevalent do you think homosexuality is in the NFL? If you had to put a percentage, there's a 53-man roster on every team. There's 32 teams. So, you know, there's roughly, you know, 1,500 players, right?
Look,
there's 1,500 players in the NFL.
Yes, sir.
What percentage would you put on that you suspect may be gay or bisexual?
So I remember I love stand-up comedy. And one of my favorite stand-up comedians is Jamie Foxx. And I remember he had Jamie Foxx. It was a comedy special he had called Jamie Foxx Foxhole. And he was talking about he had met with a doctor, and he was like, one in five men is homosexual. And he went through the crowd with like a homosexual metal detector, and he beeped it around. He beeped it on one person. He was like, that means one in you five dudes that's together right here in this front row is a homosexual, you know? And for me, you know, a heterosexual guy, you know, a married man, I've never dealt with that, but I know for a fact that they say that you got to protect the shield. And I'm a firm believer in that, because not protecting the shield can break down a lot of teams. And I can honestly say I know a lot of players that's in the NFL that's very, I don't believe in being bisexual. I believe that if you like the other, if you like the same sex, then, you know, you're a homosexual, you know. And if that's your taste, look, I have homosexual family members, you know, and lesbian family members. And, you know, I don't look at them any different. And, you know, I call the guys in my locker room my brothers, and I don't look at them any different. You know, your preference is your preference. My preference is my preference. I'm not going to look at you any different. Nothing is going to change, you know, because, you know, you might run a Fortune 500 company that I might need a job from later on in life, or you might have to save my life one day. You know what I'm saying? As a doctor. So for me, I don't look at it like guys like that, you know, or judge them, because I know what I have. But I can definitely tell you from a personal experience, there's a lot of guys that's in these locker rooms that are very homosexual. You know, they don't go out. Some of these guys don't go out to the normal bars. You know, they go out to the bars across the way, and, you know, that's their preference. That's their preference. But, you know, that every NFL team has FBI agents that work for the team. And when you go through the NFL combine process, they grill you pretty hard with just uncomfortable questions just to see if you're going to tell the truth or not. And majority of these questions that they ask you, they're asking you these questions just to see if you're going to tell the truth, because guess what? They already know. They already know who you are before you get there. You know, and that's what Bill Belichick, he's a, you know, at the beginning of the docuseries, he came on and he's like, you know, I personally blame myself, because we really vet each and every player here to fit our organization and our organization standards. You get what I'm saying? And
yes,
we don't single guys out. You know, we try to bring the best guys here that can help our organization. And for them, you know, they like you heard Bill Belichick say, he said, we knew what we had, what we were getting ourselves into, and we should have helped him way more than what we actually did.
There's no question. So back to my original question. You said a lot of guys you think are gay in these NFL locker rooms. If you had to put a percentage on it, there's 1,500 players roughly in the NFL. If you had to put a percentage, right, 10% of 1,500 is 150.
I'd say about, you know, 13%, you know. I'd say about 13%.
Okay, well, why specifically 13? Why specifically 13? So you're essentially saying, you know, about 200 guys in the NFL, you probably would guess are gay.
Yeah, most definitely. I think guys are homosexual in the closet. Some are out. Look at this.
and I personally can't say no names because I'm not that guy that spread rumors or anything. But some of these people's best, these favorite football players are homosexual, you know, and they would never
superstar know, football players.
Superstar football players.
Wow.
Superstar football players are homosexual. And I would never disclose any names because I'm not that type of guy that would ruin the locker room. You know what I'm saying? And,
sure.
You know, that's these guys' preferences. I don't look at them any different. I look at them as, you know, the guy that's going to fight next to me on a Sunday. You know, I don't judge them. I don't walk past them when we're in the lunchroom. I go sit down with those guys. I got to fight with you. I don't care about anything. I'm going home to my wife and kids, you know? You know,
are you gonna buy your son a pink jersey for it?
No sir, I'm not. You know, okay. Now we have
just asking.
No sir, I'm not. You know, now we have a breast cancer awareness game. He can go wear wherever he want. You know, but you know, if the team is issuing it, but you know, I'm not the one that's gonna, you know. How do I say this? I'm not going to put homosexuality off onto my kids. That's not what I don't believe in that. I don't believe in being with the same sex. I've never been a fan of that. But at the same time, I understand where our world has come to now. And I understand, you know, the acceptance of homosexuality. And, you know, one thing I was always taught to never, like, look down on anybody. Like, my mom has always taught me that. Never look down on anybody. You never know when you're going to need help. You know, like, most people from my community don't like to deal with the police. But if something happened in my community, I mean, something happened to me or my family, the first person I'm calling is the law. You know? So I never look down on anybody or their preferences. I know what I believe in and what I stand for.
And that's fair enough. Let's move along. UCLA football. As an alum, as a fan, as a former all-conference player and a first-round draft pick out of UCLA, what are your thoughts about the state of UCLA football right now?
Oh, my gosh. We're under fire right now. We're in a fire that's hard to get put out right now. And a lot has changed since I have left UCLA. Number one, Instagram. Instagram, everybody, you know, wants to be famous. And it's already hard because most guys, you know, UCLA is in a beautiful area in Westwood. It's a beautiful place to go to school. You know, you got the mansions in the backdrop. You got these historical buildings. You got beautiful women walking around all day. It's, you know, you got Hollywood within miles of walking distance. You got Rodeo Drive. You got everything in that area. And you got, you know, you're close 5 miles from the beach. And, you know, I started my career off at UCLA under Rick Neuheisel. And Rick Neuheisel was the greatest salesman I ever met. Rick Neuheisel could sell water to a whale and salt to a snail. And he, by far, personally, in my eyes, is probably the greatest recruiter. I think that UCLA needs to consider hiring Rick Neuheisel as the athletic director, just strictly off his ability to recruit and keep guys composed. You know, I played under Rick Neuheisel. We didn't have a lot of success under Rick Neuheisel, but what he did was he recruited a lot of talent. So once Jim Moore came in, Jim Moore was able to capitalize and implant in these new, you know, into these new kids, the younger kids and the upperclassmen mind, you know, that this is it. You know, if you want it, you have to go get it. You have to earn it. You have to show me, you know, and we're going to win games. It's going to be tough, but we're going to win games. And, you know, a lot of people thought that with the hiring of Chip Kelly was going to bring that Oregon type of success, because a lot of times we saw Oregon line up with a lot of players from California, you know, guys like Kenny Rowe, DeAnthony Thomas, and et cetera. And, you know, UCLA guys thought that, okay, we're going to be special under Chip Kelly. Well, Chip Kelly's a tough coach. He's hard, you know, from what I hear, he's a coach that's very hard to deal with, you know, but I personally met him, and I just thought that, you know, he was a great guy personally. So for me, I was very confused on why a lot of guys were actually transferring out of the program, going to other places. I was actually confused on why our recruiting classes haven't been as strong as they've been in the past. It's just a total debacle over there. The basketball team is not doing well. You know, UCLA was known for, you know, people would clown and say, oh, no, UCLA is a basketball school. Well, shoot, it's not a basketball or football school right now, you know. And I think that, you know, I had a chance to talk to Deshaun Foster this past year. And, you know, personally from his word, you know, from his mouth, what I got out, he was pretty much like a lot of guys are having trouble with dealing with Chip Kelly as being a new coach, but Jim Moore recruited him. And for me hearing that, I was just like, oh my gosh, that's such a soft mentality. That's an excuse that's very soft. I think that the captains and the leaders of the team, you know, are soft for even letting guys, younger guys even think that way, because at the end of the day, it's all about banding together, winning games, and going to the next level. You know, a lot of people, a lot of kids in college don't understand that you need the guy next to you in order to get good looks. And my senior year, you know, we didn't really start winning a lot of games until I was a senior in college. A lot of people don't understand my success of going first round came from guys buying in and banding together, winning big games, and, you know, blowing teams out, and everybody being dominant across the board. So, you know, I can have free range to get one-on-ones. Anthony Barr can get free range to get one-on-ones. Eric Kendricks can run through gaps. Jonathan Franklin can break long runs. Brett Hundley could throw, you know, to anybody across the field. Receivers can run routes, catch passes, and get drafted. And, you know, we had a lot of team meetings and a lot of player ran practices in order to create that special bond. And now I feel like a lot of guys are, you know, we're recruiting now. You know, I think the worst thing ever is I'm seeing in recruiting is like guys go to these colleges and put these jerseys on and take pictures. I'm like, man, forget, they can't wait to post it on their Instagram. I'm like, man, forget all of that stuff. You know, I had a great coach. My first coach, I think, which inspired me once I got to UCLA, was a coach by the name of Dwayne Walker. I know you're very familiar with Dwayne Walker. And Dwayne Walker, Raheem Moore, you know, he sat down with Raheem Moore, great safety out of UCLA, and myself, we were roommates. And he put us to the side. He said, I want you two to come meet with me today. And don't bring anybody up. So we met with him, and he turned on the Tennessee film. He showed us a clip of a guy by the name of Arian Foster at Tennessee. And we're watching Arian Foster's best clips. I'm talking about every time he ran, he broke at least two tackles when he was at Tennessee. And he said, you two guys are going to have to tackle this guy. He said, the recruiting trips, those steak dinners, those, you know, meeting with, talking to your parents and this and the third, buttering you guys up every time I see you, that's over. He said, you guys got to start becoming grown men now. You guys got to start buying into the program, because the program is going to be ran by you two guys. The program is going to start with you guys. We're leading the charge. He said, everybody in this recruiting class is not like you guys. They don't have the same talent. So in order to get everybody else to follow and start getting more guys like you guys got to be the example. And I don't think that UCLA has those type of guys right now. I don't think USC has those type of guys right now either, to be real. But, and that's why a lot of kids are escaping California and going to all these other schools, because they all, you know, all these kids want to have an opportunity to get one-on-ones and line up next to great players and, you know, form, you know, get themselves a chance to get drafted. And I think that, you know, it's going to take more than the coaches at UCLA. It's going to take the players to buy in.
If you were back in high school right now, would you consider UCLA? Knowing what you know, Chip Kelly's a tough guy to deal with, and the culture that's there at UCLA, would you be a guy interested in UCLA right now back when you were in high school?
Well, you know, I committed to UCLA under Carl Durrell when I was a junior in high school, and I made sure, you know, thick or thin, I was committed to the program. You know, one thing that helped me get there to UCLA was not only having, you know, great – you were my personal defensive coordinator and defensive line coach in high school. So you knew exactly what was going to help me succeed as far as in, you know, picking the right college to help me go to the next level, which I always appreciated that. And for me, I just think that it's – you know, if you commit somewhere – you know, dang, that's a hard question to answer right now. But I don't even know if I would consider it, but I know I wouldn't leave California. I know that for sure. I wouldn't leave California. It would be tough.
Yeah.
What we did in my recruiting process, we actually recruited each other. We recruited about 20 guys who all wanted to win. And we all became really good friends. And out of those 20 guys, I think maybe like 13 of us actually went to the NFL. And I just believe that bond that we had in the recruiting process set the standard for all the next guys to come. And once we all graduated, most people didn't really know that story about our recruiting class and why it was special and why it put UCLA back on the map for so many different reasons. And I think that if I didn't have that bond with those type of guys, I probably would have went to USC. I probably would have went to USC, you know. And I just try to tell guys, like, man, the way recruiting works, you got to recruit who you want to play next to, you know. So I knew when I was in college, I knew, okay, I got a guy, he's not as good, but I know we got a kid at Oaks Christian High School. His name is Cassius Marsh. He's going to be a really good D-tackle one day. He's going to be a really good D-tackle one day. He's now a deep outside linebacker, defensive end for the Arizona Cardinals. But I said, man, you know, Brian Price is leaving UCLA. I'm going to need somebody to help free me up. So you know what I did? I took it amongst myself to go out and recruit. You know what? Give me Cassius Marsh personally on his recruiting trip visit here. I want to host him. I want to host Owamba Bay Odigi Zuwa. I want to host Brandon Willis. I want to host Anthony Barr and Eric Kendrick. I want to host Fabian. When we go to training camp, I want Fabian Monroe, the true freshman cornerback, and Ishmael Adams to be in my dorm room. You know, and that's what it took, just for me to create one-on-ones and help everybody else get one-on-ones in college, and you know, for us to get off the field early, because I know what it felt like going 4-8 at UCLA, and I know how great guys could be, you know. And I knew a lot of kids that we were recruiting had a chance to go to the NFL. So my mission was, okay, as much as I'm making myself better, how can I make the guys next to me better?
Yeah, absolutely. It talks about, you're talking about ownership, right? Taking ownership of the team, taking ownership of the recruiter. What needs to change? And this is the last question about UCLA football. What needs to change directly or indirectly moving forward? Because right now it's like Chip Kelly's on the hot seat. If he doesn't get anything done in his third, he could be out. What needs to change immediately, indirectly or indirectly, with UCLA football?
I think they need some coaches. I think they need coaches that just understand that we need to make these guys better. We need to treat our veteran players like true vets and not like kids. If we're not making these kids better, then we're failing them. Because, you know, I remember, like for example, I had, you know, I got Jim Moore my senior year. I played under Jim Moore for one season. But Jim Moore brought an NFL coaching staff into the program. He brought a great defense coordinator from the Pittsburgh Steelers, Lou Spanos. He brought a former player from the Atlanta Falcons, and he was just coaching at the Seattle Seahawks, Jeff Olbrich, as the linebackers coach. He brought a great defensive backs coach Demetrius Martin, Eric Yarber on the receiver staff, offensive line coach, what is his name? I forget. But we brought a total staff of a pro guy and guys who's only coached on the pro level. So pretty much what he did was he was holding guys accountable to playing on the next level. You know what I'm saying? It was like we were in the NFL, but we were in
High level of accountability.
You know what I'm saying? We all had a high level of accountability. And I remember when, you know, I came back from my senior year and pretty much Jim Mora was going to bench me. Jim Mora and Lou Flannels was going to bench me because, me being the most productive football player at UCLA over the past 3 years on the defense, I felt like I just had it. Well, they were like, those days are over when guys just feel like, you know, I'm going to be the starter next year, I'm better than him. Those days are over. The days are now. A lot of guys are buying into that, oh, I'm a 4-star recruit, I'm a 5-star recruit, I should be starting. If I'm not starting, I'm transferring. You know, that's why a great kid, you know, I had a long conversation with a kid named Jalen Phillips. And I was telling Jalen Phillips, I said, look at this, bro. You was a 5-star athlete. You was a top-ranked outside linebacker in the nation. You was putting up crazy numbers at UCLA. Why transfer now? Why would you transfer now? You're supposed to be coming out with Chase Young this year in the NFL draft, no matter what. You know what I'm saying? And I said, yep. The reason why you left was because Chip Kelly challenged you, and he challenged the rest of you guys out here on this field, and you guys tucked your tails and you guys ran from that challenge because you guys hadn't been this tired in the past. You guys haven't been challenged like this. You guys didn't get the Jim Moore that I got. You guys got the Jim Moore that was going through a lot of scrutiny as a family man. And you guys got the Jim Moore that was going through a lot of mental issues with, you know, going through a divorce. And that's ultimately why the program let him go. You guys got that Jim Moore. You guys didn't get the fired up, emotional Jim Moore that wanted to win games, that wanted to be dominant, that just wanted to rip guys' heads off, be dominant, run the ball down guys' throats, you know, off, you know, great defensive line coaches, great linebacker coaches, DB coaches, receiver coaches, special teams across the board. You guys didn't get that. You guys got the back burner of it, and you guys turned it to a Hollywood show because what you guys saw was three defensive linemen getting drafted in the first round. You know, there was only one defensive lineman that got drafted in the first round before me, and he was a defensive tackle, Toyasa Sofo. Now, I believe that was in the late 80s, you know. So, into me, there weren't no first-round D-linemen. You get what I'm saying? The next guy was Kenny Clark. Then the next guy was Takaris McKinley, you know. So, you know, guys start seeing it. Guys start seeing Anthony Barr, Jordan Zumwalt, Jayon Brown, Eric Kendricks, Miles Jack, all getting drafted high. And guys thought that's going to be me without putting in any work. Not realizing that these guys that went to hell and hot water to actually become the guys who they were today. You get what I'm saying? And a lot of these kids aren't bought in, and I think that it's going to take the coaches to actually, you know, break them. And I agree with Chip Kelly on some of the things that he's doing, but I think that there needs to be some type of player development there to, like, be around these kids to actually get these guys in line. Hey, I know things is hard, but you can't just run away and transfer and think that you're going to go to Oklahoma or Boise or Oregon or wherever you think you're going to go and get your own way. Man, you got to go through some battles. Maybe Chip Kelly is challenging you because he sees something special in you. He might see that you can lead the charge a different type of way. And he needs to be harder on you because he know by being harder on you, your competition level is going to go to a certain level and actually make everybody else's competition level go up as well, too. You get what I'm saying? And I just think that, you know, it's all about bringing the right guys in now. And I don't think he's found the real recipe on doing that now.
That's fair enough. Let's move along. Our last topic, the Dallas Cowboys. They just hired Mike McCarthy, your former head coach of the Green Bay Packers. He drafted you first round in 2013 to come be a five technique. You moved around on the defensive line. You played the interior. You played the exterior. You played outside linebacker. Eventually, you went off and signed with the Minnesota Vikings. But now Mike McCarthy is now the head coach of the Dallas Cowboys. What are your thoughts about Mike and then him pairing with the Dallas Cowboys?
Oh, my gosh. Most definitely. A lot of people don't understand Mike McCarthy is a one-of-a-kind coach. He's definitely a great offense guru. He's definitely a mastermind. He's definitely a player's coach. And what I can see from Mike McCarthy is he's definitely going to bring a winner's mentality into the locker room. Mike McCarthy is a super player's coach. He takes care of the players, takes care of the players' bodies. Their mentals. He's a real family man, so he's real big on like guys getting home to their families, you know, taking a step away, taking time away from, you know, the football field, being home with your families, recouping your mind, and you know, coming back the next day and going to work. He's not a Charlie fuck around type of guy. He's all about work, and he means work. He all he wants to do is win. And he would do anything to win. And I think that for him, he's going to help their offense tremendously. He, you know, Mike McCarthy runs all the quarterbacks. You know, he runs the quarterback camp. He's been doing it for years. And, you know, he's perfected it with Brett Favre and Aaron Rodgers. And, I had personal witness to seeing it. The biggest thing that I'm looking forward to seeing is how do they change their defensive mind set, because you know when you draft the defense over these years, you kind of draft to the actual defense that you run. So I'm kind of thinking, are they going to run a 3-4 defense, or is he going to bring a 3-4 guy in, or is he going to bring a 4-3 guy in? You know, because when I was in Green Bay, he had Dom Capers, you know, a 3-4 guy, you know, and we pretty much ran nickel probably 70% of the game with two defensive tackles, you know, 2-3 techniques and two elephant outside linebackers. You know, and I'm really looking forward to seeing how he runs things exactly with that. You know, playing under Mike McCarthy, we went to the playoffs every year that I was in Green Bay. And every game that I lined up in, I really felt like we were very prepared. Our minds, our bodies, and our mental. I used to tell a lot of guys when I was when I was in the Dallas Cowboys locker room, I used to always tell the guys, I'm like, man, like, we beat you guys in 2015. The reason why we beat you guys is because we were more rested and we were more prepared. You know what I mean? I told Dez Bryant the year of the catch. I said, man, you caught that pass. A lot of people don't know, like, the funny story about Mike McCarthy. The year after Dez Bryant catches that pass, right? I mean, the next day after Dez Bryant catches that pass, we go on and win the game. Mike McCarthy comes into the locker room. He's like, God bless those Green Bay refs, because Dez Bryant caught that ball.
Yeah, he definitely, it was a catch. There's no question about that.
Yeah, it was definitely a catch. But one thing a lot of guys don't realize is, and I think, and this is the important thing that I think that guys need to hear, is that he's real big on sports science, on how to win games. And, you know, he's real big on sports science when you lose games as well, too. So he always has an algorithm, whether it's more sleep, whether it's more training, whether it's more, you know, walkthroughs, whether it's just more doing the little things to win a game. I was telling Dez Bryant, you know, my former teammate, he was like, man, what made y'all different? You know, besides having Aaron Rodgers over there in Green Bay, I said, Mike McCarthy. I said, literally, there were times, I said, we knew we were going to beat you guys in the playoffs because we knew that you guys' bodies were too tired. We knew that you guys' bodies were too tired. You guys weren't going to be able to keep up with us because our bodies were just more rested than you guys were. And we, you know, we would do more walkthroughs and have more mental preparation on our assignments than just killing each other and being down. And what I saw from the Dallas Cowboys this past season and the seasons
in the other years were that guys' bodies were just too beat up to compete. You know, I hadn't seen Tyron Smith. I hadn't seen Tyron Smith finish a season, a full season without getting hurt in a long time. I hadn't seen, you know, Travis Frederick finish a season without getting hurt, missing games. I saw Amari Cooper running to line up as a receiver, limping this year, you know?
And we're checking himself out of the game.
You know what I'm saying? And I was just like, guys, bodies are hurt. You can't go through practice every day like this training camp and expect to just dominate guys. It doesn't work.
Is that what was going on in Dallas when you were there? Where, I mean, were guys practicing really hard late in the season?
It was training camp every day. It was training camp every day. No knock to the coaches because, you know, everybody went hard. Nobody broke. Nobody cracked. Nobody, you know, complained. It was, you know, this is what we're here to do. We're here to do this. But at the end of the day, the recipe that I had was going to the playoffs every year. Well, you know, I'm a guy that's used to going to the playoffs. It was Green Bay. You know, we went to the playoffs with Matt Flynn and Seneca Wallace that helped us win games when Aaron Rodgers broke his collarbone my rookie year. You get what I'm saying? We even had Vince Young in there. So the recipe was more mental reps, more preparation, like more mental. Like when guys' bodies were beat up, you know, from playing a Sunday game, we got to play a Thursday game. We'd do all walkthroughs the whole week. You know, why run into each other? We just played on Sunday. You get what I'm saying?
Right.
If I know Clay Matthews got a groin, why am I going to push Clay to failure when I know, you know, he could win, you know, get a strip sack to win that ball game for us? So I know Jordy Nelson or James Jones or these guys need a little bit more rest because we just ran 90 plays in a hurry up offense. You get what I'm saying? So pretty much, you know, Mike McCarthy is a wizard at, you know, knowing when to load guys up and knowing when to deload them, and everything doesn't have to just be a pound and ground situation. You know, this is not the 90s no more. You know, this is a much faster game with guys with more fast twitch muscles. And, you know, a cheetah can't run every day to catch his prey, you know. It can't. It's impossible. And
no,
I think
no question about it.
Yeah, I think that what Mike McCarthy is going to bring into the organization is going to be something new, but it's going to take a lot of guys to be grown men about the situation to buy in. Okay, just because we're taking more walkthroughs don't mean that it's time to dick around. You get what I'm saying? We're taking a walkthrough. Now you can detail your assignments. You can detail your hands to walk through. You can detail your steps real slow, because when you're doing it slow, eventually you can do it faster. You can do it faster. Now you get really good at technique. You know, he's real big on his fundamentals. He's real big on technique. And, you know, he's real big on guys finishing. So I think these guys are going to have a real great time having him as a head coach. I'm really excited to see what they're going to do on defense this year. And I think that Jerry Jones hired the right guy, Jerry Jones and Stephen Jones, and I think they're going to have some fun in the near future, you know, probably hanging a banner under Mike McCarthy.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't think there's any argument that Mike McCarthy is a great coach. I mean, he won a Super Bowl. You don't just win a Super Bowl by luck, that's for sure, with the Green Bay Packers. Now the new Dallas Cowboys head coach, and he has talent in the cupboard. It's definitely not there. Guys are getting a little bit long in the tooth at certain positions, but there's still a lot of young talent, especially at the linebacker position, the wide receiver position. Zeke is still hungry and ready to go. They got a more than capable quarterback behind center, and they got a lot of things in play. So thanks so much for your input and your outlook on the Dallas Cowboys and Mike McCarthy Daytona. I appreciate you as we wrap up this
show. Thank you so much for
jumping on the Transparent Truth.
Most definitely. Thank you for having me. Good luck in the near future. Hopefully you guys can get me back on soon.
No question about it. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Daytona Jones, former first-round pick, 2013 Green Bay Packers, and now media personnel and personality until he gets himself back into the NFL. Thanks a lot. We appreciate it.
Most definitely. Thank you.
And now I'd like to bring this show to a close. Thank you so much. Please check back next week. Transparent Truth, you know we got it popping. Coach Keith, there's a new sheriff in town, and his name's Reggie Hammond. Y'all be